Hello and welcome to The Doctor Will Hear You Now, the podcast hosted by me, Dr. Zoe Williams. Now, I'm a practicing GP, a medical professional, but in this podcast series, I'm not the expert. In The Doctor Will Hear You Now, I'm here to learn from you. Each episode, I'll face a health condition which is riddled with stigma and misinformation. By passing the microphone, literally, to a well-known name, join me as I learn their story. Plus, with the help of our wonderful series sponsor, Bupa, we'll be joined a bit later on in each episode by someone who has a lot of experience in the subject matter. Together, we'll leave each episode with a greater understanding. This is The Doctor Will Hear You Now. As a GP here in the UK, the trajectory around today's topic has been a really interesting one. When I was in medical school, we were actually taught how to pick up on the most subtle of body language in our patients, because it was kind of accepted back then that it was unlikely people were coming to in front of the doctor and let them know that the issue was with their mental health. And fast forward to today, I think it's widely recognised that our mental health coexists and is just as important as our physical health. But the question is, do we actually find it easy to talk about it? Maybe with the doctor, but what about with our friends? What about with our family? Are we able to pick up on when we are struggling with our own mental health as easily as we do with our physical health? Well, I'm really lucky to be joined today by Anna Martha, who is a psychologist and an author, but she's also someone who's been very open and very honest about some of her own struggles with her mental health. And that's what we're going to hone in on a little bit today. So thank you so much for coming and welcome to the podcast,
Thank
Anna.
You so much for having me.
I think the first question I'd like to ask is, what is the one thing you should never say to somebody who is struggling with their mental health, or more specifically, perhaps someone who is in the midst of a depressive episode?
When I read that question, got a little bit of intel beforehand, it took me straight back to a moment in which I shared with my friend, good friend of mine, that I was experiencing postnatal depression, that I was in a really, really low place. And it was a huge thing for me to do that. It felt like a very hard thing to say out loud. And incredibly well-meaningly, she said, but Anna, just think of the good things in your life. You've got a husband that loves you. You've got two children that you're so lucky to have. And I know that it came from a really good place, but it made me want to climb back into that hole, I think, that had been such a big thing for me to kind of step out of. Gosh, I'm already emotional and we've just started.
Yeah.
But it just, I think it's a really hard thing to hear, because We move very quickly to that place of gratitude. I love gratitude. It's changed my life. But I think we can very quickly use it as a tool to beat ourselves up with. And I think when people are feeling low, often the response can be, but I should be grateful. But there are good things in my life. I've got a job that I love. I've got a home that I feel safe in. And we can so quickly rush to invalidate some of these feelings that actually we really need support in. So I think it would be that, really. You know, we know the things we're grateful for, but if someone steps out and is honest with you, then it's, I think, about really choosing to come alongside them and hear what they're saying.
I mean, I think that's really, really powerful. And I'm sure many people probably think back and may reflect on a time when they have said something of that nature with good intentions, because what you automatically want to do is make that person feel better. It's what we want to do. But it doesn't, because actually that person's feelings of whatever they are, if they're struggling with their mental health, whether it is depression, whether it's anxiety or something else, they wouldn't be saying it if they weren't feeling it. And actually, even though they have some great things in their life, it almost disvalidates their emotions. And we know that, you know, depression can affect anybody. You could have the most perfect, wonderful life. It doesn't make you immune from mental health conditions. Yeah. And actually, I work in a really deprived area of London. I work in Peckham in an NHS GP practice. And sometimes I'm heartbroken by people's lives because they have such difficult lives, but they've got really, you know, their mental health is really in a really good place. They're really happy and, you know, they're really joyous. And actually, even though they have very little, and many of us might think, well, you might think that person would be depressed. They're not, because that's not, it's just not how it works.
Yeah, Absolutely. And I've been the person giving those words as well. Mm. And I think ever since then, I do try and hold back. Sometimes I have to almost metaphorically like sit on my verbal hands and think, no, they know the things that are good in their lives, but actually they need me to hear what they're saying.
I'm going to ask you one question now, because I really want us to focus on Anna, not today, not the professional Anna Martha, the psychologist, but actually I think what would be the right response to that? You know, if somebody's thinking, oh, I've made that mistake. But, you know, if a friend or a loved one or a colleague or a family member actually confides in you that they're struggling, what would be a useful phrase or question that you could follow up with?
I think just saying, wow, that sounds really hard. I care about you. I'm here for you. What do you need? Do you need someone to listen to you? Do you need some advice? And I think that's a really helpful question to pose, because many of us are fixers and we quickly, you know, all this advice comes to our mind and we want to help.
Yeah.
But sometimes people just need to be sat with. So it kind of gives the option.
Yeah.
So that's often what I lean to.
Okay.
Now.
That's really helpful. Moving on. So the next thing I want to do is something slightly different on this episode to what we have done on other episodes. I think we should both check in on our mental health and how we're feeling today. So I want to ask you, first of all, how are you?
Recently, this season of life that I'm in, I've got three young children, work's busy. I feel sometimes like I'm living on a treadmill and I can't find the slowdown button and my legs are just going really fast and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this isn't that sustainable. And then I recognize do you ever play the when then game? You know, when it gets to the weekend, then I'll slow down. When I've got this work project out the way,
yes,
then I'll slow down. When my kids are all at school, then I'll get some breathing space.
I've never heard it referred to as that, but
the
when,
yes, then game.
That resonates.
And I think I notice I end up just kicking the can down the road,
yeah,
of my own, kind of meeting my own needs. So I'm really trying hard to think, actually, I need to meet my needs today. I need to get a bit of that breathing space today. And just trying to think of often quite creative ways to do that. This morning I got up, my husband left for work at like 10 past six, so I was awake. And actually he woke me up early because he just turned over and breathed on me. And it just drives me mad. So I was like, ping, I'm awake now. But actually, you know, I did 20 minutes of yoga and then I had a shower before the kids came storming into my room. And that, to me, it gave me something. So I'm trying to stop playing the when then game and just holding out and just trying to think, how can I acknowledge, validate, meet the need today? So that's really helping me on that treadmill.
Good. That's I hate getting up early though.
Do you?
I'm trying to think, would that work for me? But no, I know I'd just, even if I'm awake, I'll lay there in bed till the
last possible
minute.
Maybe that's what you need. You know,
yeah,
maybe that's what you need. And it does take going to bed a little bit earlier.
Oh yeah.
Which I'm not very happy with.
Oh,
Matt.
Are you?
Yeah.
Yeah. You see, I'm a night owl. And you know, it's in your genetics, whether you're a night owl or an early bird. It's your chronotype. It's in your genetics. And I come from a family of night owls. So I do struggle with going to bed.
But do you get that time in the evening? Do you kind of claim that as yours? Do you do things?
Well, I heard something recently, which I'd never thought of before. It's called sleep procrastination. Because I've been questioning, why do I stay on the sofa until 11:30 midnight, knowing I'm going to be exhausted the next day? Why do I not just go to bed? Why do I sit there thinking, I should go to bed, I should go to bed, I should go to bed, but I don't go to bed? And it's called sleep procrastination. And apparently, you know, because we now go home from work and do all the stuff you need to do, nursery, pick up, dinner, bath, bed. So that by then it's about 8 o'clock, then you eat yourself. So it could be 9 o'clock and then I've got a bit of work to do. So it's 10 o'clock. So it's 10:30 before I get onto the sofa. And we actually need a block of time to switch
wind
off.
Wind down time.
And wind down.
Mm.
And that's why, because my need is for that switch off time and because I've done everything else. So it made me think of it differently. Rather than beating myself up over staying up late, I just need to have slightly stricter boundaries with getting that time for myself. And the reason I tend to not eat with my child is because I want to eat with my partner when he gets home. And we actually had a conversation the other day. I said, I think I'm going to start eating with him, because by the time you get home, it's so late by the time we've done everything that's another hour. So I think I'm going to start eating at 6:30 with him, which is better for me in a number of ways. And it means I can get that work done and then I've got time and I can get to bed earlier.
Yeah, that's a good thing. A little tweak.
You've got to really analyse, haven't you? And I'd never thought of this sleep procrastination before. And
yeah, little tweaks though, just kind of moving
things
about,
don't they?
To get a bit more for yourself.
Yes. So how would you say your mental health has developed over the course of your life?
Vastly. Totally different. Mm. I'd say I'm a completely different person. There are so many markers that I can look back and recognize that. So, for example, I've been married now for nearly 15 years this year. And when I met my then boyfriend, we were in a nightclub at Loughborough University. Yeah. And for a very, very long time, I felt utterly undeserving. I felt like, oh my gosh, how is this guy even wanting to be with me? I just thought he was the best thing since sliced bread. And I was just waiting for him to realize that he'd got the raw end of the deal. And now I look at him and I think, we deserve each other. I'm so grateful to have this good guy in my life. And he's equally lucky to have me too. So that just shows to me that sense of self-worth that has just totally shifted over the years, where I didn't feel good. I didn't feel deserving of good things. I didn't like myself. I'd go as far to say at points I really hated myself. Whereas now I just have this appreciation for my messiness, the grey areas, my dysfunction, the things that I'm working on, accepting myself on that journey. So that's just one way I think that my mental health has just changed over the years.
What do you think was the reason or the causes or the reasons and causes of your, what you just described? So when you were back at university, that lack of self-worth or feeling that you weren't deserving or weren't enough, where does that come from? Because it's common, right? It's really, really common, especially amongst girls and women. Where does that come from?
So I've thought about this a lot with my therapist head on, and I've had a lot of therapy along the way too. I'm really privileged to have experienced that. And I look back and I think, like many people, I grew up not feeling totally validated with all of my messy emotions as a child. So there was a lot of trauma when I was young. My younger sister had cancer. She had a brain tumor that was diagnosed when I was about, I must have been about 7 or 8 when she was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And that kind of threw us into a lifestyle for a few years of uncertainty and kind of grief that we knew we were going to be experiencing. I think there's a word for it, isn't there, where you're kind of anticipatory grief, where you're living in the kind of waiting room, you know there's going to be loss. And the way that was dealt with in my home with my family, I would say really impacted my sense of worth. I tried to be really good. I tried to be really neat as a person emotionally. There was so much fear. There was all these kind of medical, you know, appointments and radiotherapy, and our life kind of really was shaped around my sister's cancer treatment. And then she died when I was 10. And there was just so much grief, and I saw my parents hurting, and that was really, really hard. So I thought it would be a really good idea if I was just a good girl.
Yeah.
So I internalized a lot of the usual messy emotion that we feel. I didn't want to be angry. I didn't want to be difficult. I didn't want to share my fears and anxieties that much because I didn't want to worry them. They were feeling enough as it was. So I think that was kind of a coping mechanism that just became a lifestyle. And I carried on like that for a long, long time. I was the helper. I was the one that everyone came to. I was the one that gave out the good advice and said the nice things, but I found it incredibly difficult to allow myself to need people, to allow people to support me. It led me into a journey with eating disorder, I think just by ways of controlling and trying to manage the messy emotions inside of me that I didn't really know how to articulate or be vulnerable with other people around. And that, you know, that led me to being a therapist. And I think I'm so glad I'm a therapist, but that was all also another way of me, you know, I don't want to talk about my emotions. Let me help you. Let me talk about yours. So it was a real way of kind of sidestepping me. Didn't realize that when you train to be a therapist, you get therapy. And I thought I didn't need that. I thought it's fine. I know myself. I'm all good. And it just really, it was a real journey for me of just slowly recognizing that I needed people. So I think that's where that kind of perfectionist tendency that became a personality. And I felt like an imposter. I felt like everyone knew me as a good, nice person, but all the mess and all the kind of anger and the confusion and the anxiety, that was all inside. So I just felt like an imposter in my own life. I thought everyone sees this, but really I'm this. So that what they're loving, what they're liking, what they're befriending is a version of me is not real. So I felt really undeserving of friendship and relationships and love, because I just always thought if they really knew.
Yeah, what if they found out?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot, isn't it? Because you were a child. Mm. And to take all that on, that feeling, that responsibility to be a good girl, not make any trouble, not make things more difficult than they already are. And maybe that's why you became a psychologist, because you get to talk about it. But also you're helping people, aren't you? You know, you're feeling like you have an important part in the world. You're helping people. I guess, again, it's another thing that validates you. You're doing a job that serves others.
Mm. Yeah, it was very much about earning. You know, if I'm good enough, I'm nice enough, I'm helpful enough, then maybe I'll feel deserving of friendship and love and kindness. But I never did.
So how did you change that to where you are today? And I know that's a question that you obviously cannot answer really in a few sentences, because I'm sure it's very, very complex. But, you know, if you can give us an idea of how did you manage to go from there to where you are today, where you now rightly see yourself and your husband as equally deserving of each other?
There were two different main times. There was a time around kind of depression when I just got married. It was 2009. And then there was another period, a really low point postnatally. So I could talk about either of those moments.
Let's talk about the first.
Let's talk about the first one. So I had just got married and my eating disorder was very active. I was running. I'm 10 kilometers a day and barely eating anything. And I just remember having no energy at all. I didn't feel like I could stop this behavior. It was a very externalized way of me knowing quite how much I was kind of punishing myself. And I think I started to realize how much it was impacting on those who loved me, cared about me. I remember going to the doctor and I was so confused as to why I wasn't getting periods. Totally and utterly confused. I thought I was pregnant. I'd done pregnancy tests. I asked for blood test to see whether I was pregnant. And there was absolutely no mass to add up, no biological mass that would add up to explain why I was pregnant. But that's how dysmorphic I was. I remember standing on the scales at the GP surgery and she was like, this is why you haven't got periods. And it was a real light bulb, a painful light bulb moment for me when I started to realize that it wasn't just me that I was harming anymore. I had this new husband and we'd spoken about having children and I was getting night sweats and my body was just really struggling. And I started to realize that actually I was harming our future. I was harming, you know, I was worrying him. It was hard for family to see me in the way that I was struggling. And I found it really horrible when just knowing that people recognized that I was in a bad place, because that was really opposing to my, don't worry, I've got this, everything is good. And I remember one day I got back from a run and my husband was working in London and I stood in this flat, we were living in Kent at the time. And I felt so low that I was just staring into space. Yeah. And I felt like I didn't even know where to look. I felt frozen. And it was really, it just, in that moment, I knew that there were two ways to go then. It was either down or it had to be different. And I think I loved my husband and I knew that the only way that we could have a future was that for me to kind of seek support and help and find a different way to live and a different way to manage emotion. And that was a real turning point for me, standing in the kitchen. I remember it so well, staring at the fridge. And then it was in that moment I had to allow myself to be vulnerable with people. And it was really, really scary. I remember being honest with a friend and I feared that she would be shocked, that she would be horrified at how I'd been feeling, but she wasn't. And she just responded with kindness. And I think I hadn't been able to respond with kindness towards myself. So that really, yeah, it just really encouraged me to recognize that I needed people. I needed, and that wasn't failure. That was just humanness.
I guess it goes back to that conversation we had at the start, that your friend responding in that way was more powerful than she would have ever realized at the time, because it made you reflect on how much you needed other people, but also how you hadn't been kind to yourself and how that felt for someone to be kind to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And it set off this kind of chain of different things of me just pushing beyond my discomfort and knowing that I needed to do things differently. I needed to talk to people, even if I wasn't sure as to how the heck it could be helpful. Yeah. I needed to address the way that I was exercising and eating. And I knew that, I mean, again, it was just so conflicting of the internal narrative and the kind of the unconscious ways of seeing the world that I had. But I just knew that there had to be a different way, because I valued my relationship. I valued my husband more than I valued myself. So initially I did it for him.
Yeah.
But the wonderful thing, I think, is often, I say this to all the mums I work with, if you do it for your kids to start off with, if you do it for someone that you love, let that be your reason. But then in time, it started becoming about me, because as we start treating ourselves better, and as I started allowing myself, making myself be vulnerable with other people, it started building up my self-esteem, my sense of worth. So then it became about that. It didn't have to be about other people.
I think we get it wrong, don't we? I think in some ways we tend to think that if we're holding it all together and we're being strong and we're caring about other people, that's brave. But actually the hardest thing to do, especially if that is your personality or it's the way you've grown up, it's the way you've armed yourself, or the way, you know, in your situation, it's really understandable how you got there. But actually the hardest thing and the bravest thing is to allow other people in. I remember somebody once explaining this to me, because I resonate personally a lot with some of the things you've said. It was when I had some therapy, and she said to me, she looked at me, she went, "You are so selfish." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, when a friend comes to you or a family member comes to you with their problems, and you're then able to be there for them and help them and support them, how does that make you feel?" I said, "Well, that's what makes me feel good. You know, that's my comfort zone. I like that." She said, "And you are not letting the people that love and care about you feel that greatness that you feel that warmth. You're not giving them the opportunity to do that. And that's selfish and that's mean, because they want to do that and you're not even giving them the opportunity." And that was really, that really turned it on its head and made me realize that, you know, I'm not protecting them. I'm not saving them. They're missing out on an opportunity to be there for me. And that helped me open up to some people when I was struggling.
Yeah, it's a real gift, isn't it?
Our brains trick us.
I know. And that really does turn it on its head. And if I look around my life and I think about the relationships that I have and the ones that are the most rich and the ones that are the most meaningful, they're the ones that know more of my story.
Yeah.
They're the ones that I let in.
Yeah.
And it just, I really do think that there is a strong correlation between vulnerability and kind of the richness and depth of relationship. And I don't feel like an imposter in my own life anymore, because there are people who really know me.
Yeah.
People who see behind the scenes, who don't get the I'm okay.
Yeah.
And actually, they're the people that I know that I'm lovable.
Yes.
I know that I'm acceptable, because there are a few people in my life who see me at my worst and my messiest, and they love and accept me.
Yeah.
So therefore,
They
don't run away. So therefore, I don't crave it from everywhere else in the world.
Yes.
Because I'm anchored by that. I've got a little anchor tattoo on my hand, actually.
Oh, I love that.
It's a tiny one. And it's just a reminder, just to anchor myself in the fact that I'm lovable and acceptable by the people who know me at my messiest.
And you, I'm going to talk about your book in a minute, because I just love that. Because you have, that's your art. You have these just little phrases that have so much meaning behind them that actually can be, I think, life-changing. It's really powerful. So I think, I guess, going back to your life then, we talked about university, you lacked self-esteem, you felt that you were so lucky to be with your partner, and you said how, you know, these two periods of depression in your life were really pivotal in that. So what happened? So you recognized that you were depressed, and this friend had some kind words. What was the road to recovery from there to where you are now? Obviously, I'm sure with many bumps and dips in the road.
Yeah, so it was really about starting to act as if I cared about myself, regardless of how I felt. So there was a long period of time where I had to make choices that were really conflicting with what I wanted to do and what I felt like I deserved. But it was the kind of, and I always use the little phrase, you know, more of the time, not all of the time. So it's a bumpy old road, and, you know, one that I don't think I'll ever fully get to the end of. but that's okay. And so, yeah, it was really about just the choices that I was making and what statements those were making about me, even if they didn't fit with how I saw myself.
And I guess, and the proof that you did get better is that you have three children.
Yeah.
But it was after your second one, was it,
yeah,
that you then had postnatal depression? I think people would assume that as a psychologist, as a professional, you know, this is your world, this is what you do, that you would have really great insight,
yeah,
into your own mental health. And
yeah,
you think that I was as a GP would as well, and I didn't either, but you didn't recognize it, did you, for
no,
a while?
I just thought the reason that I felt so rubbish was because I was failing at motherhood. And I think I just couldn't see the wood for the trees. I was chronically sleep deprived. So my second and the first one, he was so straightforward that I totally thought I'd done a good job and it was actually me as a parent that made things straightforward. So I took that really personally and I was like, right, I'm going to copy and paste that whole experience on this second baby and it's just going to be, you know, it's going to be great. But he had undiagnosed silent reflux, a tongue tie. So he basically screamed for 6 to 9 months. And for a long time, I thought, I'm trying to do everything right and nothing's working. Therefore, I'm the problem. And I was so chronically sleep deprived that at points I was hallucinating.
Gosh.
And I said no to I had friends and family that were worried about me. I was crying as I was feeding my toddler on the table. I was just so exhausted. And my husband wanted to help, but I literally would, I made him sleep in a different room because I did not want his help in the nights. I did not want his support because for me, accepting that just further kind of confirmed the fact that I was failing. I thought, this is my child. I should be able to comfort him. I'm obviously not trying hard enough. I'm obviously getting something wrong. And I think the fact that I was so tired, I couldn't see the wood for the trees. I couldn't think clearly. You know, I could barely remember my own name.
Mm-hmm.
So I just didn't have that perspective. I didn't have that. I couldn't kind of zoom out and look at how things were because I was so deeply in it. I remember saying to my mum on a rainy walk one day, pushing the double buggy, you know, when's it going to get easier? She said, it will. There'll be light at the end of the tunnel. I was like, when? I need to know.
Yeah.
When is this light going to come? And it did. But again, it was another one of those kind of standing in the kitchen, staring at the freezer moments where I knew that I needed people and I needed to let people in. And finding that period of motherhood hard was not a statement of my failure at being a mother. It was just the fact that it was hard. And I was just finding it hard. It's having a human response to the circumstances.
Yeah. But at the time, but building up to this, I guess, well, the sleep deprivation really prevents you from being able to see things, I guess, in the way that you would otherwise. So how did you realise that it was postnatal depression that you were suffering from? And I guess, what was your experience? Because I'm sure there is evidence out there to say that we would all end up with depression if we were sleep deprived enough. It's almost like it's inevitable that if somebody is sleep deprived to the extent you are hallucinating, that it's definitely going to impact on your mental health. And I think for most of us, significantly enough to be deemed depression. Was it that, or was there something else? Having had a past history of depression prior to that would mean that you would be at higher risk. So how did the diagnosis come about? And
yeah,
and how did you, I guess, rationalize?
So it was all of the above. You know, it was hormones, feeding was a real challenge. I really struggled to breastfeed and I was so determined. I'm incredibly stubborn.
Mm.
But I'd breastfed my first one. So I was like, I am doing this. And I literally had family begging me to stop so that I could get a break and rest. And it came to a head again, really, where I just felt like I couldn't function. I'd gone from crying behind the scenes, sticking on mascara, you know, going out into the sunshine with big sunglasses and my double buggy, knowing that anyone looking at me would have thought I was smashing it.
Yeah.
When in reality, I was so scared that people would see my vulnerability. I didn't want them to see it because I worried that I might fall apart completely. And I thought, I can't completely fall apart. I've got these two young children and I didn't know how I'd be able to put myself back together again. And I think it just pulled back another layer of just how I needed to work a little bit more on my self-esteem and time and my deservedness for support. And I think at the time I thought, my goodness, I've flipping worked on this already. I've gotten better at accepting support, but it felt like a step back when actually it was just a step up. It was just another level. And I had to really challenge that sense of failure, and I just had to let people in.
And did you then? Yeah. So you eventually you showed that vulnerable side.
Yeah.
And you allowed them, you let down the barricades to the village, and the village came and
yeah.
And the village helped.
I did. And I remember the moment, it was, I had my baby in our room and my husband was upstairs. And I just remember I was just sat there crying all night. And I knew that my husband was desperate just to come and support me and just to be with me. And I remember going up to the bedroom. He was upstairs. It didn't even have a door on this room. It was just like in the eaves of the house. So he would have been awake anyway. And I said, I need you to come down. And he did. And he couldn't help. He couldn't stop it, the screaming. He couldn't get me sleep, but he was there. And I think it was just another one of those moments where so often we think, what's the point in telling people, because they can't help, they can't fix it. But actually there is so much value in allowing people to just be beside you and with you. So at least you're not alone in it. And I had to let go of that belief that the fact that my child was struggling, the fact that I was finding it hard meant that I was failing as a mother. Yes, that was that moment.
Well, I think when we talk about mental health generally, the message that those of us that have expertise in whatever way in the subject, and those of us that work in the media, the message we tend to give more than anything else is just let somebody know, just talk to somebody, just let somebody in. But, you know, as you've just explained, on two occasions, as someone who really does understand and has the knowledge, and it can be so hard. And that actually, I guess what I'm learning from this conversation with you is that comes from the problem that's within us in the first place. So in this period of having a baby, sleep deprived, because actually your mental health was negatively impacted just by everything that was going on, it actually, when you want to you want the universe to make it easier for you to ask for help, it actually makes it harder, because you're already, all that negative self-talk is going on and you're already persecuting yourself. Mm. And it makes it harder. So the harder things get, to some extent, the harder it is to ask for help, until I think for some people, there comes a complete crisis point where you have no choice. And yeah, then
it's like a rock bottom.
Open.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think no amount of degrees or doctorates or, you know, no amount of books that we've read will ever stop us from needing people. Mm-hmm. Like it's a human thing. And I think we like to think that we've, you know, I've got this, when actually the most powerful moments of my life have been those times I've kind of waved the flag of surrender and said, you know, actually I don't, and I need people. And that, yeah, again, that's not a failure or lack of strength, because actually, I think it's Brené Brown who says if vulnerability was a weakness, it wouldn't be so hard.
Yes.
You know, so it's a real
amazing,
strength.
Isn't it? So yeah. True. So it's interesting. So then hearing your story, you've got to where you are now in a really great place, but it's actually taken two really difficult times in your life for you almost to be, I guess, forced into submission to allow the people in.
Yes.
And then allow them to see the real you.
Yeah.
And learn that, oh, well, actually, you are lovable and you don't have to pretend anymore or be a good girl all the time. You can be you.
Very liberating.
It's okay.
It's very liberating when you really start, you know, it's been a bumpy journey. And I think that's why I'm so passionate about supporting people in coming to a place of self-acceptance, in our brokenness, in our messiness, in our dysfunctionality, and, you know, not playing that when then game with our own mental health. You know, only when I'm really struggling, then I'll get help.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm going through something really bad, then I'll tell people. But actually now.
So I can think our message to people out there then is, if you're struggling, don't wait for things to get terrible. Be brave. It's hard. It's really hard. But just be brave. And let somebody who cares about you know, let them help you. Don't be so selfish, keeping it all to yourself.
It's a privilege for other people, the right people. It's an absolute privilege.
Let them have that joy of being there for you.
Yeah, and then experience the richness of relationship that comes with vulnerability in time. And it does get easier. It's like a muscle.
And I tell you what, one thing that really does test your physical health and your mental health and your social health is having children, and you have three, so congratulations. I have the one. That's hard enough. But I think your own experiences, you've really, as a psychotherapist, you've really honed in on mums now, haven't you? Because you recognise the need. And this book I absolutely love. You've got a new one coming out in August, but this one is the Little Book of Calm for Mums, for new mums. And what I love about it so much is that I know the thought of reading a book cover to cover when I had a baby was just so overwhelming. But with this book, you don't. You just have a little flick to the contents page, and there's a long list there of all the various different things you might be experiencing in that moment as a new mum: bad day, procrastinating, resentful, feel like a burden, grateful, unsolicited advice. So you just flick to the page of whatever it is you're experiencing, and not only do you give just one sentence that I think, if you think about it, which is your art, it really resonates, but some takeaway actions as well. So I love to flip to anxious because I'm an anxious parent, which I didn't expect. And it says, imagine the anxious part of you as your scared inner child and try to reassure and comfort her. Mm. And I love that because what you do is, I don't know, it's a bit like the magician's circle. I always think within the field of psychology and psychiatry, it's almost like there's loads of secrets that you can't share. You've got to commit to a year of therapy in order to get the benefit from it. But you recognize, and you're passionate about, in the same way I am, often the people that need it most cannot access it because either it's expensive or there's long waiting times, or actually through the NHS there's a limit on the amount of therapy you can have and the types of therapy you can have. So the reason this bit really resonates with me is when I did have therapy, we did a lot of inner child work, which is, you know, quite complicated and complex. But actually what you've done there is, in one sentence, whilst it wouldn't be as impactful as doing 6 months of therapy and getting to know your inner child and understanding and going back and experiencing what they experienced, I think even that you can actually, it is helpful to use those psychological theories, but simplify them and put them in the mainstream. And what sort of a response have you had from people utilizing this book?
I just love it that people have said they carried it around in their changing bags and have just kind of kept it on their, you know, on their bedside table, just grabbing those words. And I think that idea of kind of mothering ourselves in those moments is so far removed from how we can approach our own anxiety sometimes, which is, for goodness sake, what is wrong with me? Why am I thinking like this again? You know, that kind of angry teacher. Mm. And this is saying, actually just mother that part of you.
Yeah.
It's often more effective being gentle with ourselves.
Yeah. And then another thing I want to ask you about is burnout. So I think burnout is quite a new topic for a lot of people. Definitely, it's something that's being talked about more. I think within my field of medicine, especially general practice, you know, we're all aware of it now because of our own experience, but also of patients. But you've experienced this as well, have you? Can you tell us a little bit about your experience of burnout?
So for me, I think there are two reasons I've experienced burnout. And I had one particularly physical experience of burnout, which I'll mention. It's the kind of circumstantial pressures of life. So this was post-pandemic, when I'd just been keeping on. I think burnout often happens when we have to push beyond the limits of our resources chronically, and we can't meet our needs and we can't have our feelings validated in the way that we might need to. So there was a circumstantial element to that burnout. And then I think there's this other element that can lead to burnout as well, which is the pressures that we put upon ourselves. So, you know, whether we think, no, I need to be coping this certain way, or I should be doing these things, or I should be juggling all these balls, or I should be achieving all of these standards. So I think those two things, especially when they come together, because there are certain things about circumstances that we can't change, especially around what people kind of journey through the pandemic. But there are other elements that we can in time learn to change, which are the pressures that we put upon ourselves and how we allow kind of the, you know, the cultural narratives to really dictate where we put our standards. Anyway, it was after the pandemic, and we were due to go away for the first break as a family, to my husband's family home in Wales, which they were soon selling. So this was like going to be the last time that we could go, and it was really kind of long awaited. And I was so burnt out. Every time I even thought about packing for a family of five to go away for a week, I started feeling panicky. Mm. I started just feeling like, that's one thing too many. I cannot do that. Even the thought of sitting in the car for like 3-4 hours with the kids and all the noise and the constant snack requests and the dropping of the blah blah, you know, I just thought, I can't, that just felt too much. And I remember my husband going out and taking the kids so that I could get a start on the packing, and he came back 2 hours later and I was sat on the kitchen floor, and all I had packed was a water bottle in a bag. That was it. And I said to him, I can't do it. And it suddenly occurred to me that there was an option that we might not, that we wouldn't go. And we decided that we wouldn't go. And I felt really guilty. But then I remembered that actually, you know, if you book a holiday and you put it on a credit card, a family credit card, then that's the family's debt to pay. That needs to be repaid. And I realized that what had been put on the credit card over the pandemic was me doing and home learning and trying to hold everything together and going and going and going. And that had a real cost. And that cost was a collective debt that we as a family had to find a way to repay. And that was for me, that was a really great way of looking at it, that a few years before I wouldn't have looked on it like that at all. Yeah. I would have felt guilt and shame, and it would have driven me further and further into trying to compensate and do more stuff to push myself further into that place. But it was a very visceral experience, burnout. I'd felt waves of burnout before, but this, it was like my nervous system was raw. It was like I didn't have any skin. Every noise felt like amplified. Every decision that came my way, even what do you want for dinner? I felt like it was the biggest choice. I couldn't make it. And there was a little more I could do than just to lie and stare in the quiet. It was like my nervous system just needed rest. And that's really hard to find in a busy home. But it took a long time. My resources were very limited for quite a while. Things would stress me out quite quickly. I'd get irritable quite quickly. There were lots of things I didn't do. So I really kind of slimmed my diary down. There was no way I could work. I couldn't. And I had to really start learning to respect my body in a way that I hadn't done before. I was in a good place, but the circumstances, you know, and my perfectionist standard, which I'm always working on, really just stripped me back. And I've now got a whole new respect for rest, which is hard to find. I have to be very creative about it.
Yeah.
But I recognize the more I give, the more I need. And my kids will often ask for stuff, you know, just something silly. And I'll say, you know what, I'm just having a rest for a moment. I need them to learn that we need rest, and that doesn't stop at childhood. I'm quite boundaried now. And I remember saying to my therapist, it's as if my parenting depends on me going on a walk, because I find that really nurturing. She was like, yes, that's because it does.
It does.
You need. So it really, you know, it was another layer of learning for me and another respect for burnout. Yeah, it has changed my life, really.
There was one of your posts on Instagram that resonated with me, actually. And I think it's the one where you say you plug your mobile phone in to charge. When you lie on the sofa, think of it as plugging yourself in. You've got to charge. And I don't know whether it was in a podcast or on that post, but you said how there was one time you were sitting down on the sofa and your husband was coming home. So you jumped up and made yourself look busy. I do that all the time. You know, if I'm just sat chilling, like, oh, don't want them to catch. It's almost like, because I've been so busy, I don't want them to think that this is what I've been doing all the time. I want them to know that I've been doing this and that and the other. And then when you look at yourself and think, but my partner would be pleased if he walked in and I was sat taking a rest. That would make him happy to think that I was taking a moment for myself. But you do, you know, we're such complex. Our brains are so complex, aren't they?
Yeah, it's a challenge of identity, isn't it? So much of our identity and our sense of purpose, and, you know, is just on our output.
So in a moment, I'm going to bring in Petra, who's going to add something extra to our conversation. But I think before we do, I'd love to ask you one last question. And that's for people who are listening to this conversation. What would be one message you'd like them to take away from this when it comes to mental health and depression?
Well, there's so many different things. I think, put your blinkers on. If you're having a hard time, don't compare yourself to someone else who's having a worse time. Or it's almost like being in a hospital bed. You have got something going on. The doctors, your team are seeing you as a case, just you. They're not thinking, you've only broken one leg. The guy next to you has broken two. So actually we're moving all our research. We don't care about you. We're not going to do your obs because you've only broken the one leg. You know, I think often we don't get the support that we need because we think about someone else who's more deserving of that support. So we end up invalidating our own situation. And I think sometimes we just need to put the blinkers on and think, you know what? I'm one person. I'm one case. I'm not okay. And I deserve and need support.
I love that. That's great. Annette, thank you so much for just being so honest and being so brave and so open. I think it's quite rare, actually, that people with your clinical expertise are also so willing to share their own experiences. So I really value that. Thank you.
Thank you. I always think there's a real privilege to being a therapist and that you see behind so many closed doors that you know you're not alone. So I can speak these things out without shame.
Yeah.
I know that I'm not alone.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And what an incredible role model that is as well to other people. So thank you. Before we continue with this important conversation, here's a quick message from our sponsor, Bupa. Depression isn't just about feeling a bit down. It's a real condition that needs taking seriously. The good news is that there are treatments for depression and support that can help you manage the symptoms. It's important to remember that depression isn't a sign of weakness and it's not something people can just snap out of. If you've been feeling down or hopeless nearly every day for at least 2 weeks, and or you've lost interest or pleasure in your usual activities, then you may be suffering from depression. People develop depression for lots of different reasons, and sometimes it's not possible to pinpoint one particular cause. It's often a combination of several different things. These may include factors such as a stressful life event, such as a bereavement or a relationship breakdown, a family history of depression, or perhaps if you've recently had a baby. As a Bupa member, if you're struggling with your mental health, you can talk to them first. Bupa doesn't cover you for conditions you have before taking out the policy, but you'll have reassurance for future conditions which may arise. Bupa will listen in complete confidence and help you to access the treatment and support you need. Search Bupa Mental Health for more information. And we're joined again now by the lovely Petra Simic, who's Medical Director at Bupa Health Clinics. You've been listening to our conversation. And first of all, let us know a little bit about your experience and expertise when it comes to mental health and depression.
Sure. So I'm a GP. So I've been looking after patients for the best part of 20 years. I'm also a mum. So I've got two kids that are now in their early and mid-teens. So I have my own experience of the challenges of being a new mum in what last decade now, but and also being a professional, a healthcare professional, going through those challenges. So a lot of what you said, Anna, really resonated with some of my own personal experiences. For me, I really enjoyed as a GP doing postnatal checks with new mums, particularly once I'd had children of my own. So for me, that was really interesting hearing what you had to say, and resonates a lot with a lot of my own personal and professional experiences.
So having listened to our conversation, please do let us know, you know, if you picked out anything that you felt needed correcting or anything that you want to comment on or anything that you thought was really interesting that we could talk a little bit more about.
I mean, it was incredibly insightful and I thought absolutely nothing to correct. I think so nice to have this real open dialogue. One of the words that struck me, you talked about being messy. And I thought that was great that you used that word, because often when I come across people who are struggling, and when I think about when I struggle myself, it's all around that desire to be in control, to be seen as doing a good job and nailing it. And I think there's an awful lot of pressure that people put on themselves, probably more than ever, to be perfect of everything. And I'm not sure whether that's related to social media, the appearance, the veneer of perfection that people display, but no one displays that kitchen behind the picture of the beautiful food, or, you know, no one posts on social media when your kid's having a tantrum and you can't get them to eat their carrots. And I think for me, that giving people permission to both be imperfect and a guidance to lower their standards is really important if we're going to A, prevent people from developing this overwhelming sense of insufficiency, but also help people who are trying to recover as well. So I thought for me, that was a great word, messy.
Messy.
Let's be more messy.
Yeah, no, that resonates with me as well. I think one of the things I found really surprising actually about becoming a mum is how hard it is. But I think I've gone through life having had some challenges, and probably bigger challenges than most of my friends, but I've been quite resilient and I've always been able to do stuff. perhaps a bit easier than most people. So whether that is whatever I've turned my hand to, I've been reasonably able and capable. But then all of a sudden I was a mum and I felt like I was less capable and able of doing that than the average person. And it really shook me because I've not experienced that before. And I'd see other mums with multiple children, you know, getting on the bus. And I'd look and I'd think, just this admiration thing, I don't understand how they do it. But then immediately turn that into, well, just because I'm just not very good at this, am I? You know, I'm not good enough. I think that's my experience, that constant criticism, which is, I think, Anna, what you're so good at, almost talking mums out of, or finding a way to help them see it more for what it actually is, rather than this negative voice that we have in our heads that we tend to turn to.
Yeah, those statements are really powerful, aren't they? And we can jump to them so quickly. We just see one thing and then we turn it into this entire statement about who we are as a person, how well we're doing. And I always think the heart hears what the mind speaks. You know, we're just affirming this message and it's strengthening this message, which is chipping away at our self-esteem. So I think sometimes it seems someone's doing a better job than us. Maybe they are. We don't know what other areas of their life that they struggle in that we don't.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're falling apart on the inside.
Yeah.
And it's this, just think, recognizing that we're just making up stories.
Yeah.
And not to turn that into an entire shaming statement often about who we are. And the power that that has when we do that.
Yeah.
I think it's really important to remember there are some physical things going on as well that are absolutely impacting as well. So the number of times in a postnatal check, the mum will come through the door and I can physically feel her fatigue. You know what it's like when you're next to someone who's exhausted and you almost feel tired for them, and just the amount of sleep deprivation is horrific, and that really impairs your ability to recover, to reset, to have healthy hormones going through your brain. And one of the common conversations I have is around, well, how much sleep are they getting? What is their sleep pattern? And I find the other thing that really impacts on that is the pressure to successfully breastfeed. And as a doctor, I'm acutely aware that the medical profession is very consistent in its messaging to new mums that breast is best. And there's lots of evidence to show the benefits of breastfeeding. But women misinterpret that to mean that bottle feeding is harmful or neglectful or a failure of them as a mum. And I think, you know, you described that really well. I had my own personal experience of that. So my son at 6 weeks, I was still persevering with breastfeeding because breast is best and I'm a good mum and it's the most important thing I can do for them. And he just wouldn't stop crying. And I remember my husband saying, please, please, can we give him a bottle? I was like, what are you saying? You're saying I'm not a good mum? Are you saying that? He's like, no, I'm not saying that. Can we just give him a bottle? And I was like, he's feeding fine. Like, there's no problem with this. He's just a colicky baby. And this baby absolutely devoured a bottle and he barely cried after that. Mm-hmm. This baby that had been crying for weeks. And I realized that I'd been so obsessed with being a perfect mother, I perhaps was missing some of the other cues that were much more obvious to other people. So I have a very open conversation in postnatal checks with the mums that come in. We talk about feeding, and if they are breastfeeding and doing well, I am chuffed to bits for them. But if they're struggling with breastfeeding, we have a very honest conversation about the advantages and disadvantages, and that it's a balance. Mm-hmm. You know, the decision is theirs, and that formula is not poison or a failure. And you can do a bit of both. Nipple confusion isn't really a thing. You know, give people permission to parent rather than very strict rules. I think that for me is what I enjoy doing when I see new mums.
My line on that is always, there's a really good substitute for breast milk, but there is no substitute for a mother's mental health.
I mean, you couldn't put it better. I think that is exactly that.
You know, that we know of all the benefits of breast milk, but actually, and I guess this ties into your next book, which is coming out, that's massively surpassed by the benefits of having a mother who is thriving. And you can tell us a little bit perhaps about your next book that's coming out in August, which is really putting the focus on that, isn't it? Actually, probably the best thing you could do for your child is look after yourself.
Yeah, I think it's, so it's called Raising a Happier Mother, and it's got child crossed out because I think I've literally got a bookshelf full, packed with books on raising children. And I know that when I'm sleep deprived, when I'm hormonal, when I'm depleted, when I'm not looking after myself, I can't access any of that. You know, I'm not there in my own meltdown thinking, oh, what was that wonderful tool that I read in that book yesterday? Yeah. I'm there in fight or flight mode, you know. So actually the biggest gift that I can give to my children that enables me to access the good tools is to find ways to anchor, support, nurture, value myself. Yeah. So that's what that's all about.
I think, do you experience also as a GP that there's fear, almost definitely shame, and sometimes fear in women sharing with you in those postnatal checks or otherwise that they're struggling with their mental health, and that it, because it, they think you'll judge them or reflect on their ability to be a parent or even their ability to safely parent their children?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, there's a view that, I don't know, the medical profession is there to be judgmental. People maybe have bizarre ideas in their head around social services, or there is a general reluctance for women, full stop, to admit that how tough it is.
Yeah.
But there can be barriers to that. And I think that is the responsibility of the doctor in particular to give people permission for it not to be okay.
Yeah.
So the number of postnatal checks, they come in, they've come for their baby check as well. Yeah, I've come to get the baby checked.
Yes.
I'm not really interested in the baby at this point. I'm really, this for me is a mum check. It's not really a baby check, but we go along with that because that's what's important to them. And then if you give them permission, say, it's tough, isn't it? Isn't it, are you finding it hard? What support are you getting? You know, how are you feeling in yourself? Giving them permission for it to be difficult. And often as a GP who's had parents say, well, you know, my own experience can be very helpful to give people permission to say it's not okay. And that's very important. And I think if any young GPs are listening to this, thinking about their practice, give your patient permission to not be okay. You'll be surprised how often you'll need the tissues on your desk if you just give them space for that.
Right. And I think when the baby, you know, is 6 to 8 weeks old, I think the assumption should be the mother is not okay, but it's your job as a doctor to assess what level of not okayness is that. And actually, you know, it's for the patient to convince you that they don't need additional support. I think if you approach it that way, we're much more likely to pick up when people are struggling through giving permission. I just want to thank you both massively. I think, you know, the fact that we are sat here as three health professionals, also three mothers, who also, you know, today was learning about your story, Anna, and I'm so grateful to you for sharing so openly and honest. But I think Petra and I are both sat here thinking we've got stories to tell as well. I think the underlying message that the three of us would want to give is that if you're listening to this, you are not alone. You are worthy. And the people that love and care about you will thank you for letting them know. And your doctor, your GP, will not judge you, but actually see how brave. If you go and speak to your GP about your mental health, we've been taught in medical school and through our own experiences, and when we get together in groups and we do education and learning, we will never speak negatively about somebody. If we're using your example as a case, we would never speak negatively about somebody who's come and been open about their mental health. You're a hero. You're a warrior. You're brave. Don't suffer in silence. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining me, Dr. Zoe Williams, on The Doctor Will Hear You Now. For future episodes, to make sure that you're the first to know of their release, click follow wherever you're listening right now. Also, tell us if you liked it. Leave a rating or review or share with a friend. You can find me on Instagram at Dr. Zoe Williams, and I look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Insanity Group.
Thank you to our fantastic series sponsor, Bupa. Here's a quick message from them. Depression isn't just about feeling a bit down. It's a real condition that needs taking seriously. The good news is that there are treatments for depression and support that can help you manage the symptoms. It's important to remember that depression isn't a sign of weakness, and it's not something people can just snap out of. If you've been feeling down or hopeless nearly every day for at least 2 weeks, and or you've lost interest or pleasure in your usual activities, then you may be suffering from depression. People develop depression for lots of different reasons, and sometimes it's not possible to pinpoint one particular cause. It's often a combination of several different things. These may include factors such as a stressful life event, such as a bereavement or a relationship breakdown, a family history of depression, or perhaps if you've recently had a baby. As a Bupa member, if you're struggling with your mental health, you can talk to them first. Bupa doesn't cover you for conditions you have before taking out the policy, but you'll have reassurance for future conditions which may arise. Bupa will listen in complete confidence and help you to access the treatment and support you need. Search Bupa Mental Health for more information.